Hello there, and welcome to Beyond the Surface, where the saying to be seen is to be understood comes to life. I want to begin by first honouring the traditional custodians of the land we live and work on. I live and work on Gundungurra land, and I acknowledge the traditional landowners of my guests near and far. I pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, for they hold the memories, the traditions, and cultures of our First Nations people. The land below my feet is, was, and always will be Aboriginal land. I'm no stranger to the profound journey of pain, grief, anger, and heartbreak that often accompanies the loss of church, community, faith, and the unwinding of our core beliefs. In the midst of this, though, I found healing in the stories shared by others who walked a similar path to me. Here in the warmth of these digital walls, I want you to feel at home. This is a space where your memories and your story is not just acknowledged, but deeply seen and believed. So kick back, relax, and let's embark on a journey where your story is not just heard, but embraced. I want to welcome you to a community where storytelling is a powerful force. This is Beyond the Surface.
Welcome, Jane.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yes, I am looking forward to chatting because I know a little bit about your story already from your ebook. So I'm excited to hear, I guess, what was in written form in vocal form, which always changes the way that you hear a story, right? So
True.
it'll be great. So, tell us, where does your story start?
Oh, it's funny, as I've been preparing to chat with you, I've been thinking about Krista Tippett's beautiful podcast on being and how, which has just been like church for me since leaving church every week. She's just such a meaningful thinker. And she asks people, every single person, regardless of what they're going to talk about, she asks all of them, to start by telling her the religious or spiritual background of their youth. And every time I hear it, I think, well, what would I say to that? How would I answer that? So here I am. I think being in the 70s, growing up in the 70s, I kind of just assumed everyone was a Christian. It was kind of just in the water. I remember at primary school, we used to sing God Save the Queen, at assembly, and that, I knew that we were a Christian nation, in inverted commas, sort of whatever that means. My father died when I was almost six, but I remember before that, before he died, so I must have been maybe four or five, I would go to these meetings and I'd kind of be wriggling around at the back. And I learned later on that he was a speaker in it's called the Infinite Way movement. And it's, I guess, sort of universalism, and certainly the church that I grew up in would have frowned upon the very broad, I guess, theology, if you could call it that. And my mum was open to spirituality of all kinds. So I spent many weekends in ashrams, and I even had a yogi give me a spiritual name, Leela, which means dark and beautiful, which of course I loved. But mum was always seeking solace in all kinds of places, I guess, after he died particularly. And so she was into transcendental meditation and rebirthing, and I would get dragged along, to all these different things, just thinking, what the heck is this? But all these different expressions of spirituality while kind of going to an Anglican school by day. So I sort of had this kind of split
Not
personality.
different at all.
Oh my gosh, it was quite, I remember even as a kid finding it quite confusing. And so I kind of joke about how my teenage rebellion was getting saved. And so at 13, I kind of wandered across the road to a school hall where there was about 80 people meeting. And I gave my life to Jesus at a Christmas carols event out on the lawn, and became part of a youth group and a creative ministry team and a twice on Sunday culture. And that little group of 80 people in a school hall became a mega church. And so I grew with it from the age of 13 all through my teenage years and into my 20s and 30s. I had a community who cared about me. I had mentors and leaders and weekly direction and input, and I lived with purpose, you know, the old purpose-driven life. And there was a mission and a bigger picture to connect my life to. And I really have a complicated relationship with the way that that was exactly what I needed as a girl and as a teenager, but also with the way it stunted my growth.
Yeah. Do you remember what it was at that age, you know, being 13? We know, you know, there's so much exploration around identity and who you want to be in the world and that sort of thing. Having been exposed to so many other forms of spirituality, do you remember what it was that drew you to Christianity at that point?
I think because it was familiar.
Yeah.
So it was, I knew the story already,
mm.
and it was belonging.
Yeah.
So I went to this place where I was welcomed, and I eventually found that I belonged, and it was my community. It was my whole world. So it was Wednesday nights, it was Friday morning prayer meetings, it was youth group, it was, you know, the Sunday services, it was, you know, discipleship. It was the whole thing.
Mm.
Yeah.
What was your experience like, I guess, growing with a church that became very prominent?
I was proud.
Mm.
I was excited. I got caught up in the ego of it all, you know, like we were armed and dangerous. We were, you know, cutting edge. We were at the forefront of what was happening, you know, and very much like didn't even try to hide the fact that we looked down on everyone else. You know what I mean? Like there was growth. There was crowds of people. It was electric. There was, you know, the kind of the preeminent youth movement of the time is also a part of our church, and so I used to sing and dance on stage, and that was just so exciting, you know, like you'd pack out these venues where rock stars would perform, and it was electric. It was absolutely exciting, and the impact as well that that larger numbers of people were able to have on causes that became really important to me was also just such a great thing to be a part of. So it was just, it was the place to be in my teens and 20s. I absolutely loved it.
There must have been, I guess, also I'm thinking about what I would have thought if I was a part of a church that grew exponentially, that there must have been a part of you that was like, oh, well, this must be working. Like there are like droves of people coming, like, what we're doing is working, you know, all the prayers are working, all, you
oh,
know.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Yep.
Did that impact, I guess, your relationship with who God was?
I think it just made me more sure that I was on the winning side. It just kind of, it was just confirmation bias at its best, you know, like we were where the life was, you know, like there was nothing dead or boring about our faith. It was alive and vibrant, and it made me more sure that this is exactly where I was meant to be, and I was just in the center of the will of God. And as a younger person, I couldn't understand why other people weren't drawn to it. I remember giving some of my girlfriends in high school, back when we had, oh gosh, I'm really dating myself here, but when we had like actual records and like LPs. I mean, they're coming back in fashion now, but I was like the OG. And so I would give them like these LPs, you know, for birthday gifts or whatever, and friends who didn't come to church, because that was sort of part of my, you know, little evangelism thing. And they would be like, oh, okay, great, thanks. And I just couldn't understand why they didn't love it, like why it wasn't just awesome. So, yeah, it was a very kind of strange, strange reality to be in.
I used to do that with Christmas cards. I used to be always like very specific about giving the ultra religious Christmas cards that like turned a Christmas tree into a cross. To the friends and family who were not believers. And I just thought, like, you know, this is just the real deal. Like,
gonna nail it.
Like those Christmas, no, pun intended.
Oh, no. That didn't mean, yeah.
Not intended.
Wow.
But, you know, it's so funny because you just think that it's doing so much when in reality it's doing nothing except impact the relationship that you have with that person. Mm. It's funny the things that we sort of, you know, look back on.
Yeah, it's mortifying.
How did your relationship with God, your relationship with church impact your relationships?
I think people just sort of assumed like that it was just a given that that was who I was.
Mm.
So my faith, my openness about my faith was just part of my personality.
Yeah.
And so I had quite a close group of friends, and despite being sort of a youth group going church girl, I had a pretty traumatic family life. And so I still acted out. I still wagged school. I still did naughty things and, you know, talk smack to the teacher and all that kind of stuff. So I wasn't like, I wasn't sort of a stereotypical church girl. Yeah. So I didn't really cop any kind of flack at school. Mm. And then I guess into my 20s and 30s, it became so much about service to me that there was that connection with people as well and with groups. And so it was never something that I ever experienced any kind of pushback or negativity around, mm. At least to my face. And my mother hated it. My mother was all dead set against it.
Yes, I was about to say, what was mum's thoughts? Because
she's
into sort of very alternative spirituality, I'd say she had some opinions.
She really did. And she had been really burnt by Pentecostal church leaders as a young woman. She had me much later on in life, and in her 20s, she had been really hurt. And so she already had a whole lot of anger and disillusionment. And so it was just, she just couldn't believe it. I think that I became this little Miss Pentecostal and that I knew everything and that I was always right and that I was praying for her salvation and all this kind of stuff. And then I think when I left Sydney at 19 and moved away to plant a church with a group of other people after Bible college, God bless my soul, she just was like livid.
Yeah.
She just couldn't believe it. And she would write letters to the senior pastors of the church that I had left, and she would try to influence them, and she made a big song and dance about it. And it became a real sticking point.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting because some of the other people that I've talked to, often it is the opposite narrative. Oh, well, my kids going to youth group, you know, they're not getting drunk, they're not doing drugs, they're not out partying or sleeping around. And so it's like, you know, what harm is going to happen there? And, you know, we know that it can be very different to that. But, you know, it sounds like your mum saw your church attendance and faith as an act of rebellion.
Yeah, and it was. And I was hardcore. Like I was at everything. And so she used to get cranky because I wasn't doing my schoolwork, and rightly so. And because I was hardcore fundamentalist, like I was, you know, I wasn't backing down. I knew the truth. I was right.
And I think that is a common thread of people who, I think I saw, it must have just been like a random Instagram post, but it's like those who were very dedicated, very black and white, 100% in, the ones who are now going, what do we do with this? Like, this is so
we
much.
We fall the hardest.
Yeah, essentially.
Because it was everything.
Yeah, those who were 100% in, when you're out, it's like that, you know, they're the ones that you're seeing deconstruct, I guess, seriously and publicly and intensely, because you just have all of this that you just don't know what to do with. What was the process like for you leaving church? How did that happen?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think before I could speak publicly about it or write about it or, you know, even talk to anyone about it, I had to really process it myself first. It's interesting. It wasn't one particular thing. It took years. And I think that when I left to be part of that church plant, when I left the mega church, went to the church plant, I was there for about 5 or 6 years, came back to, I used to call it the mothership, went back to the mothership for a time, and then sort of moved overseas and for work. And then once I came back, I went to and served in another church. So over the course of about 30 years, I served in 3 churches in ministry positions, some paid, some not. And so I was kind of, it's sort of depending on which church I was connected to, there were various sort of levels of, I don't know, complexity and relational dynamics and disappointment. But I think when I look back on it all, I can see quite clear themes. But at the time, I think what I was experiencing in my body was exhaustion, but also shame and anger and frustration. But I didn't have language for it. Didn't know how to express it. I just felt it in my body, and it kind of needed an outlet, but I wasn't a critical thinker yet. So that didn't come until I was probably in my 30s. And so I had all of these sort of opposing ideas and thoughts and feelings going on, and I just had no idea what to do with them. And I think it was I would hear of people being hurt, or you know, stories of abuse, emotional, sexual, financial, verbal, and I would see things happen, and I would, you know, experience people being, I don't even know what the words are, but I guess there's a kind of a condescending sort of leadership, and then the plebs, and you're kind of, there isn't really any kind of in between. And so you're either that kind of A-list, or you're kind of just one of the plebs. And that just used to feel really dirty. I used to feel shame, you know, I used to feel like because I was always overweight, you know, like that was always judged because you had to be one of the beautiful people. You know, I didn't have all the designer label things and would just feel inadequate because, you know, the church I was a part of was all about the look and what things look like on camera, or in the, you know, in the designer pamphlets or whatever. And so I just started to feel really icky about a whole lot of stuff. So I would, and I was also, I went to performing arts high school, and I was always very pro queer. You know, I always had queer friends.
Yeah.
And I remember just feeling so devastated by the exclusion of queer people from the church, even though I cognitively kind of gave, you know, I would believe whatever I kind of had to believe as part to belong, like to be part of that belonging, but would just feel such grief and just would find it really difficult to reconcile that my friends could be going to hell. So I think it was those sorts of small bricks that started to kind of come away from the wall, even without me being able to articulate them. And then the more and more stories I heard, and the sexual grooming that I could see happening, and then later on heard about the exploitation of volunteers, the, you know, the small groups of people at the top that were amassing large amounts of wealth while other people were being treated like essentially slaves, and being told to be grateful for the opportunity. All that kind of stuff just didn't sit right. And then the church plant that I was a part of became very ugly. People were treated really badly. The whole thing kind of imploded, and it was a shit show, quite frankly, and treated really badly by the denomination's leadership. Like the way they handled what went on was just, I didn't know how I was going to be able to come back from it. And so then when we went back to the mothership, you know, I kind of fumbled my way through, but just was never quite the same. And then, yeah, we moved overseas. We moved to Fiji for 3 years, and I kind of found my way. I didn't know how I would ever serve again. I didn't know how I would ever be able to have the energy to do what I loved to do. And I kind of found my way into the international aid sector while I lived there and worked for the Red Cross. And it was transformative. And so that began a kind of long career in the humanitarian space. And oh my gosh, it was just mortifying to discover that I was like the ultimate in sort of white savior. And so I took all of my sort of missionary thinking and all of my, you know, church offerings are going to go to this thing that we're doing to help all the poor brown people. I took all of that revolting thinking into this career in the humanitarian space to just be slapped down really quickly and just be like, whoa, I'm so embarrassed. Like, and that was a really painful breaking open, but a really necessary one. And so then as I kind of settled into that, that work, I started to just go, I can't believe this stuff anymore. I can't be part of churches that are so prescriptive in what it takes to belong. I can't be part of an organization that refuses to take responsibility or be transparent or accountable for abuse. I just can't do it anymore. And that was kind of the first shift. And all the cover-ups and just that was a thing, because you can forgive people most things where there is willingness to say sorry and to say, we just got that really badly wrong. We're going to change. And this is how we're going to be accountable to you for how we're going to change. This is what's going to be different. And we're going to move forward to make sure that this doesn't happen again. But you just don't see any of that in the churches that I was a part of. And so I was like, I just can't be part of this anymore. But I think once I had made that, once I had broken away, I then realized that there was an enormous amount of anger and grief and disconnection, dislocation, not knowing where I now belonged. All of that just started to surface regularly. And because I would travel a lot for work, I'd find myself in these places where I had a lot of time to kind of think and process. I remember crying on planes, listening to music and podcasts and trying to read the Bible and trying to stay connected, but just going, I actually think this is all just coming undone. I don't think I can even believe in God the way that I used to. And that was absolutely devastating. I think apart from my divorce, it's been the most painful thing I have ever walked through, because it was a complete shattering of my self, of my worldview, of my my anchor, my foundation, my lens through which I had always seen the world and connected with people. It was just a really, really devastating time. And I had teenagers at the time as well, and I was thinking, what does this now mean for them? You know, how do I talk to them about this? How do I process this? How do I talk about faith? You know, they were still going to youth group at the time. And so there was many sort of conversations and late nights and, having to then walk through that with them as well was really painful, particularly when you just want them to connect, you know, like you want them to just have a youth group and youth leaders community. And people who care about them, community. But they have since found that in other places and with different friend groups, and we now talk about it. I've apologized to them for the, you know, for I guess a lot of what they're exposed to that was really difficult. My daughter tells me all the time, telling children to believe in hell is child abuse. And I'm like,
yeah.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think, I think everybody's, I guess, process on what it is like leaving church or deconstructing their faith looks really different. As you speak, I sort of have that imagery of like, you know, when you start pulling at a thread on a piece of clothing and you think it's just like, I'll just like get rid of that little bit, you know, but it just keeps coming and it just keeps coming and coming and coming. And, you know, for some people, it's like, you know, dropping a piece of glass and shattering and it's instantaneous. But for others, it's, you know, it's slow and it's, you know, sort of drawn out almost. But, you know, you always use the term of shattering of the self, and I love it. And I know it's not your terminology, but I still love it. But, yeah, I completely relate. I think I remember
the moment that I decided that I was going to pursue the relationship with my now wife, and lost the church community that I had, I remember thinking, like, I didn't just like gain a relationship. I just lost everything that made me, you know? Yeah. And so it is, it's like the ground below you just disappears. And you have absolutely nothing to anchor to, nothing, no sense of gravity, no sense of groundedness. What was it like for you to navigate that on a personal level?
It was really deeply painful.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, that anchor, you feel aimless, and the anchor is no longer there.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned the anger and the grief, but I would also have like panic attacks randomly. You know, like I remember running into someone from the mega church, like at a work function.
Yeah.
And just thinking, I can't breathe.
Oh, I do.
Like it was just, it's amazing how your body just remembers. You know, and other times where I've had to go back for like a baby dedication or something like that, and I'm just like, I cannot be here. You know, like the anxiety, the breathlessness, the sense of shame and fear.
It's like impending almost. I remember when I drive into my hometown, there is no way that I can get around driving into our town without driving past my former church. There's no way around it. I've looked because in those early days, it's almost like an impending sense of doom. Like it's a, you know, that sort of physical heaviness that's just like weighing on you as if you have a cement brick. And it's crushing. I feel like.
Yeah. And I think I cried a lot. I wrote, as mentioned, my ebook before. I think just writing my story just helped me process and helped me sort of put, I guess, some themes, but also just kind of put it in some sort of formation. I called it the sentimental non-believer because there's a lot of nostalgia. You know, that was my teenage years. That was my young adulthood. That was, you know, the time where I connected with people and, you know, we had really formative experiences and really intense emotional experiences.
Yeah.
You know, like being in worship and singing and crying and connecting, experiencing what we would call the presence of God. Those are all so intense and binding.
Yeah.
And so I think being ripped apart from that was so devastating because you see the sign on the door that says, "Welcome home." And you know, you truly believe that you are home until you leave and it's like you were never there. And I remember just the shock of that, going, wow. Like, you know, the all the talk about family. We're family. We're brothers and sisters in Christ. We are connected. We're community. And people showed up, you know, when my kids were born and when I was sick or when stuff happens. Like, people are there. They are for you. Apart from like when you leave, it's like you just don't even exist. And I think that was one of the hardest things. I think I call it transactional belonging because for me, that's just what it felt like.
Yeah.
I realized, and that was also shattering to just go, that was based on whether or not I was actually there. It wasn't actually about me. It was about the fact that I was there serving something bigger and I was a part of a community. Whereas I had a very positive experience with a Uniting Church congregation not too many years ago. And I remember when some stuff came out, I mean, last year, I think, or the year before, there's some stuff that came out about the mothership. And the minister from that church, and I wasn't there anymore, but she messaged me just going, "Hey, there's been some stuff in the news. If you need to talk, I'm here. You know, are you okay?" And I just remember sending it to some of my girlfriends going, like, is this even real? The bar is so low for what is kindness and what is connection and genuine care for other people, whereas what I experienced was transactional belonging and false intimacy.
Yeah.
It's like this sense of as long as you're part of this, you matter and you're important to us. But as soon as you walk away, you don't.
Yeah.
And so that was part of the pain as well and the shame of it all.
What was it like? You know, you just sort of alluded to the fact that some of the things had come out quite publicly. What was it like navigating that sort of on a personal level, but yet it's so public also?
It was funny, there's a documentary that came out not so long ago called The Kingdom that Mark Fennell put together, and I was in some of the video of some of his services in the 80s and 90s, just go, oh my God, like I could see myself.
Yeah.
Other people wouldn't have recognized me, but I knew that I was in that service. And yeah, that I've never watched any of that stuff because I'm so allergic to sort of tabloid style media. I'm not a big consumer of sort of the news and stuff anyway, but I've never really watched any of it until I knew that there were sort of more credible forms of journalism, and when some of it was just factual news stuff that was coming out, this is happening on a day-to-day basis. There was still anger, there was still grief. And I had to really stop myself from spiraling down into, you know, endless doom scrolling, because we know that the internet is a hateful place when people just pile on each other and it's just like rooms where there's lots of screaming. And I had to really stop myself from going there. And I had to avoid people who I knew were going to trigger me, basically. I'm just like, I don't need this.
Yeah.
I just don't need to go there.
Yeah.
And I had to just process my own grief and anger at it, I think, in my own way. I wrote some blogs. I kind of, you know, just, I think also because in one of the instances, I was in the service back in the 90s, in this 1999, I was in the service where the big announcement happened about, let's just say it, Frank Houston, you know, where that all came out.
Yeah.
I was there that day and I remember thinking, wow, poor Brian. Like, it was interesting. And I just remember going, I'm speechless even now to kind of even talk about it. How did this become so centered and focused on how it impacted him when we didn't know the extent of it. It was minimized, it was played down. So we thought it was something that maybe happened a long time ago that was just a bit of a, you know, something inappropriate. But the extent of his pedophilia, it was just horrifying.
Yeah.
And so I look back at that now, and the way that that was minimized and covered up and played down, and it was just devastating to me that I had been so conditioned or had become swept up in something that was so disconnected from the reality. And I think also that type of church and that brand of sort of Pentecostalism, it tends to want to kind of move with the powerful,
yeah,
and you know, and the vulnerable just kind of trail along,
left behind,
you know, picking up the crumbs if they're lucky. And there's still grief for me and regret that I was part of that.
I was only saying in a recording a couple of days ago with Liz that, you know, part of the pain of deconstruction and the grief is not just about what was done to you, but about what you did to others and
what I held up, what I supported.
Yeah. The role you played in keeping that going. And
absolutely.
And it's a really, you know, as a queer person, the pain that I caused onto other queer people, I don't think that grief will ever leave me. And I think the day that it does, I lose part of who I am also.
Humanity.
Yeah. But it is a really difficult part of deconstructing and, you know, untangling those experiences. How
a
do
lot
you...
of self-compassion required.
Yes.
Yeah. I have to just say to
absolutely.
Myself, you did what you thought was right, given your environment, given what you do. It's like what Gabor Mate says about how you trade your authenticity for belonging. And so, you know, you do anything to belong, and so you shut down a part of the truth of who you are.
Yeah.
And it's only sort of on reflection that you can look back and just go, oh God, that's heavy.
Yeah. And I guess it sort of goes back to a bit of what you said about accountability and remorse and responsibility. And I guess that concept of when you know better, you do better. And I think that is probably where that tends to come in, that we miss from some of the leaders in the churches that we have been a part of. How do you come out of, I guess, what is, you know, you labeled as fundamentalism, essentially? How do you come out of that and not go into, I guess, a fundamentalism of a different kind and just go, because I know you are not anti-God, you are not anti-faith, you are not anti-church, you are anti-fundamentalism. So how do you not come out of that, though, with complete and utter cynicism about religion and go straight to the all or nothing response of I hate it all?
Burn it all down.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I definitely haven't always done that well. and I think also once a fundamentalist, often always a fundamentalist, unless you can disrupt that behavior.
Yeah.
And I was fundamentalist about, I think I've been on every diet going. I haven't dieted for a very long time and I will never again.
Yeah.
But I would become evangelical about quitting sugar or the liver cleansing diet or this new form of exercise that I've now found that everybody has to do and this is the only right way. And or even, I don't know, like pick your thing. Like, if we're going to do something, it has to be done this way.
Yeah.
So I carried over my very kind of rigid thinking of black and white, lacking in nuance. The church world I grew up in still does not do nuance well. It's very difficult to hold opposing things in each hand and be okay with that tension. So I still have to fight that natural tendency towards it. Things have to be done a certain way, but I've definitely softened a lot since then. In terms of religion and faith and God, I think working in the humanitarian space or the aid and development sector has been such a gift to me in that way, because I've been exposed for, you know, almost 17 years to so many different ways of being spiritual. So lots of different religions, and even within the Christian faith, lots of different ways to be a Christian.
Yeah.
Lots of different ways to culturally express your Christianity. Working in places like Indonesia and India, where they're multi-faith, and they're so good at, like, the communities that we used to work with, our global partners were just so good at bringing together, you know, even in Bali, you've got the Hindu local council leader, and then you've got, you know, someone else who is Buddhist and Christian and Muslim, and they all kind of have their areas within their community,
the
and they
the
work
round table.
Together. It's beautiful. You know, they're like, and then the Christian church comes along and says, okay, well, we'll do this bit. And interfaith life is just so normal and accepted. And I do understand it and respect it as a lens through which to see the world, depending on where you're born and, you know, how so many of my, you know, my good friends, but also beautiful people I've met through my work who I'm still connected to, they hold a very strong faith. And I think that's how they navigate and move through the world. That's their community. I understand what it is to be part of something.
Yeah.
And because they are from where they live, if that makes sense. They belong to land. They belong to culture. And so it's just part of that. Whereas I think in Western culture, we're disconnected from that. And so we can pick and choose things, whereas for them, it's so much more a part of their culture. So for me, that's been a real gift in being able to hold some more nuance. And it also actually helped me walk away from the black and white thinking, because it helped me see, actually, seems like turns out there's lots of different ways to view the world.
Yeah.
And actually don't have to fear, you know, the
shades of gray
or the whatever, you know, like I can go to yoga. And I will never forget the first time I did yoga in Bali. We used to, the organization I worked for had a regional office in Bali. And I remember going to do yoga at this place near the office one day, and it was Kundalini yoga. And there were all the different sort of Hindu symbols and statues and things all over the room. It was this beautiful space out in nature. And I was shaking. Mm-hmm. I was so anxious because I thought I was just turning up to a yoga class. I didn't realize it was going to be this whole kind of spiritual experience.
Yeah.
It turned out to me to be one of the most powerful things I've ever experienced. And I experienced what I, at the time, would have described as the presence of God.
Mm.
And it made me just go, huh, this is actually something that's accessible to me anywhere.
Yeah.
It's not just when I'm, you know, in worship or in church or with a group of believers singing worship songs or, you know, like it was a really powerful experience for me. It helped me just shift and be able to kind of move forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there days where you miss it?
No.
Nice.
Definitely, no, there's not. There's days that I, where I could really do with some certainty.
Yeah.
But I think at 51 and at this age and stage of my life, I've now accepted that we don't have certainty. There is no such thing.
Yeah.
That we live with, like life comes at us.
Mm.
And it's, I remember there used to even be morality around that in church circles where you must have, God was either testing you or you must have had huge sin in your life. It became like this moral failure to experience pain.
Yep.
Whereas now I understand that's just part of the human condition.
Yeah.
You know, and that there's, you know, maybe you'll come through it, maybe you won't, you know, like there's so many different ways to, I don't know, to be human.
Yeah.
And I think I would love to have that certainty. I'd love to be able to say to people, you're going to be okay. You know, I'd love to say to my kids, it's all going to work out, you know, but we just can't know that.
And I think, you know, that is one of the things that often comes up, which is that sort of your spiritual bypassing of, you know, using, I guess, non-religious language of that there is a silver lining sort of. I remember
everything happens for a reason. It's going to be great.
There was a song that I used to just like when I was going through it or I was going through pain or there was a song that I used to play and essentially it was like, what if your blessings come through raindrops? And, you know, perhaps, you know, that the pain that you're going through are God's mercies in disguise. And it's just reinforces just in really beautiful singing that, you know, see the good in the struggle.
Just trust God. Just believe God.
Yeah.
Just stand on the word, you know, stand in faith.
Yeah.
It's like, or you could just sit with the person in pain and just be present to their pain and suffering.
Mm.
Yeah.
How have you developed your own sense of spirituality and what does that look like now?
I think it's often the answer that everybody gives, and it does sound a bit cliche, but I think that I had to pursue beauty. Like I had to really find beautiful spaces in nature.
Yeah.
And again, I was really grateful in a lot of the travel I was doing as I grieved and as I healed from the impact of it all. I was grateful to be working in rural India, in Vanuatu, in provinces of Papua New Guinea, and, you know, Indonesia. And so I had these incredible jungle settings and wild orchids and palm trees and beaches and just incredible beauty. And sunsets in places like that are just stunning. And so I think I used to be really conscious that I was experiencing God in that. But for me, it shifted what God, when I talk about God, I now mean something more like what the theologian Paul Tillich describes as the ground of all being.
Yeah.
That God is love, God is beauty, God is closeness, connection. I think some of the really beautiful messages that I absorbed and needed and clung to as a teenager and in my 20s and I guess 30s, I still believe things like I am, you know, my life has value and yeah. meaning, and my life is intrinsically worthy of love, you know, that my life is connected to every other life, you know, that I'm part of the essence of, I'm trying not to sound too hippie, but like, I guess the energy of the earth, you know, like connection to yeah. other people, that it's for me that connection, that healthy connection you can have with other people, the way that you feel when you go to a concert and you sing together, that collective effervescence, you know, the way you feel when you've just done a yoga class or a run. I don't run. If I walk or if I swim, or you know what I mean, but like when you move your body,
yeah,
you're just shaking your hands to get some
yeah,
blood
dancing
flow.
Around your living room,
dancing around your living room. If you have a cold shower, you know, like the stuff yeah. that just makes you feel alive.
Yeah,
to me, that is now what I would refer to as the presence of God, or you know, yeah, the love I have for my kids. You know, like I think that kind of thing is where I find my sense of spirituality. It's in beauty, it's in nature, it's in movement, it's in the skills and the practices I'm so grateful to have cultivated in recent years that have allowed me to come home to myself,
yeah,
to be able to come back to my breath, like to know that a deep belly breath with a longer exhale is my path to calm no matter what's going on. Some of those contemplative practices have been a really beautiful replacement for what I would seek in prayer, or you know, quiet times or worship or that sort of thing.
It's like connection to the different aspects of the universe.
Yeah.
I love that. How did it change your relationship with your mum when you
I think because I was an adult and I was sort of, you know, just doing my own thing. She wasn't quite as, and we've always had a pretty, you know, strained relationship. We're just very different people. But I think she's been good enough not to gloat.
She didn't give you the I told you so speech?
She's never done that. She's, she kind of, I think she's just observed and kind of nods sort of sagely as you do when you're 89 and, oh, okay. Yeah, you know, but yeah, we didn't actually really ever kind of talk about it much, which I was grateful for.
Yeah. Did it change your relationship with your kids?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah, we, I think also because it was a gradual thing and they were still sort of figuring it out, and then my daughter moved interstate to study and they kind of were pursuing their own things. We never really, it wasn't like an event, but I think COVID was definitely, for my son, COVID was definitely the sort of, okay, so I don't know, like it just helped us sort of be able, the three of us be able to sort of consolidate. Well, we're not obviously going to church. We're not going out of the house. Like, what do we kind of opened up conversations, because we were previous to that, my son and I particularly would go to church at Easter time. It wasn't really anything we kind of made a decision to do. We kind of just went, should we go to church? Like, and we just kind of did. And my daughter would sometimes come as well, but it was, we would go to a different congregation of the same mega church, so that it wasn't quite as triggering. But but it was still a nice connection until we both kind of just one day just went, let's just not go. Let's just do something different. And we talk a lot about spirituality. We talk a lot about faith. We talk a lot about it. We laugh a lot about some of the, my kids laugh about VeggieTales and all of the stuff that these, and the various sort of trauma that they, you know, had to go to their therapists with. But But mostly it's been a really lovely connection point to be able to sort of talk about what spirituality and contemplative practices might mean for us.
Yeah. Often I find that I have a new meaning and a new sort of, I don't even know what the word is there, but like, I guess my thoughts around times like Easter and Christmas have changed and have morphed and shifted and are probably still doing those even now. How do you navigate, I guess, stereotypically religious times of the year where the world is just like, you know, you can't walk into a shopping center without hearing, you know, Oh Holy Night or something like that? How do you, does it, is it something that causes pain for you? Do you just hold it differently?
Yeah, I think I just hold it differently.
Yeah,
I think it did. I think it was painful. There's actually like a real sense of longing. There was a sense of that, like wanting to be part of something.
Yeah.
Particularly Easter was always such a tender time for me. I used to love it. It was so beautiful. But I think probably the last 3 or 4 years, I've been okay. Like I think there's. And I've been able to, I actually love All Holy Night. It's sort of like it is well with my soul. There's a couple of songs or hymns or covers or whatever that are just so beautiful still that I would, you know, I love to sing. And so it's not, I just hold it differently now. And I think I think Easter particularly is just a lovely thing, you know, the season's changing and I've actually created some new, I guess, rhythms around Easter. So I will bake, you know, food that I love. I'll make beautiful meals. I'll get out in nature and do a big walk, or I'll my partner, you know, is really handy, so we'll, I don't know, sandbag a table and paint it or like something, you know, so that we can actually be connected to something physical and grounding, and make sure that I rest. Like that's it's a nice 4 day holiday. So there's a few sort of different things that are important to me now to practice to sort of replace the ritual and the rhythm that was mine for more than 30 years, probably more than that actually, because I was at a Christian school. So yeah, it's, I think that's actually really important to do.
Yeah.
So whether it's Christmas or Easter or some other thing that was meaningful, I think it's important to replace the ritual somehow. It's like they're like grief rituals.
Yeah,
you know? Like
absolutely.
The practices that can now center and ground you to something meaningful that can take the edge off.
I think even quite early on after I had been out of the church, I needed those rituals even on a Sunday, just once a week. I don't find that I need that too often now on particularly, but certainly very early on there was a need to still make Sunday important somehow, to still create, I guess, new rituals, new practices, new, you know, anything, even if it was just something that took 20 minutes, but some new sense of renewed being, whatever it is. But yeah, I think creating new rituals, I think that's part of creating a new sense of spirituality, is finding those new rituals and practices and things. I have been finishing these podcasts by asking one question, which is, what are you saying to somebody who is in the thick of it? They are like just out, they've just been hurt, the tangling is just started to unravel. What are you saying to that person?
Oh
yeah, it's a big question.
I want to hug them. I think like anyone in grief, it's just being present. It's just saying, if you need me, I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, it's being able to reassure someone that you can handle this. You know, you can get through it. You can. Like It's going to hurt for a while. It's going to be heavy. There will be grief. There'll be anger. There'll be fear. There'll be anxiety. There'll be a whole spectrum of emotions. But you can actually enlarge your container to feel them safely and not be consumed and overwhelmed by them. And that if you are able to, like we were just saying, create rituals around, you know, what you now need that you've lost, then that is a really powerful way to come through it and to heal. But I think it's also, it's so important to find relationships and community and places and spaces where you are celebrated.
Yeah.
And where people are kind to you. Because I think it's so dislocating and it's so disconnecting and it can feel so scary. And if it is God and church at the same time, whoa, it's such a big thing.
Yeah.
So just be still, I think. I would also say just try and be still. Try not to figure it all out all at once, because it will naturally take its course.
Yeah.
If you let it unfold, and try and let go of that kind of black and white, this or that, up or down, you know, dualistic thinking.
Yeah.
Creating that room for nuance. Yeah, but oh, self-compassion, kindness, be around people who love you.
Yeah. Yeah. And who are not going to try and fix it.
Yep.
Yeah. I love that. And on that note, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
I love it. I've loved everybody's story is just so different. And yet there are some things that are just universally experienced by people who have left. I think, you know, it just goes back to that, you know, when you're really in, you're really in, and when you're really out, you're really out. And so I think those sort of universal human emotions that are experienced when you lose something are going to be glaringly similar, despite the fact that they are different people, different churches, you know, sometimes even different religions. Still, loss is still loss, right?
Yeah, and there's, and like obviously in, you know, under an hour, we've just skimmed the surface.
Yeah.
There
yeah.
is so much, you know, to do with our bodies and the way we are, you know, so disconnected from our bodies in church circles often.
Yeah.
You know, like we're kind of just, our bodies just carry around our spirit and our soul. And reconnecting with my body has been one of the most powerful things that I've done as part of the healing. But, it's a lot.
Yeah. It is a lot. But I think it, you know, it's great, I think, for people to be able to sit and hear people's stories and know that you're not alone, know that what you're going through is not just yours to hold, that there are other people who have held it and who are holding the rope right alongside you.
Absolutely.
And
it's like Maggie Smith's beautiful poem, Good Bones, you know, you could make this place beautiful. I often think of that in the midst of people's pain, like we can make this place beautiful.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks, Jane.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Surface. Until next time, take care, stay true to who you are, and remember, your voice and your story matters, always.